KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
From KCRW in Santa Monica, this is The Treatment.
Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. You can also hear this show at KCRW.com. My guest, author Patrick McGilligan, has written biographies of many major figures we associate with studios, from Jack Nicholson to Jimmy Cagney, Clint Eastwood, Robert Altman, Alfred Hitchcock. His newest book is about a man who was a pioneer in so many ways, a homesteader, a self-published author, and basically, as far as I'm concerned, the real inventor of the American independent film movement. He's an African-American director who starred in The Silence. His name is Oscar Micheaux. The book is Oscar Micheaux, The Great and Only, and its author, Pat McGilligan, is sitting across from me. Pat, thanks for being here.
Thank you for inviting me, Elvis.
I want to have you read just one passage, one paragraph from the introduction that I think really sums up the book, if you do that for me.
Okay. Usually, if nothing else, the reader of a biography can be assured of the name of the central figure and the facts of his birth and death. Yet the precise place where Micheaux was born remains elusive, nor does anyone know the exact circumstances of his death. For decades, even his burial site stayed unmarked and unknown.
Now, for me, Pat, that essentially is so much of what his life's about. I mean, shrouded in this kind of oblivion because he, for the major American film figures, is not considered to be important enough because he was black.
Well, his importance is rising, I think, both in terms of general reference people as well as in African-American history. I think it's partly because of the way in which he worked. I mean, he lived this really scrounging, hard-scrabble, as you say, independent film director existence. He was doing it out of his pocket, out of his own imagination. He dodged debts and dodged lawyer subpoenas and was arrested and, you know, taken to jail for dodging subpoenas, and all in the great tradition of an artist determined to make his films, and bank accounts in different states. Never very much money. You know, in those days, a contract director would make more money in a week by contract, by regular paycheck, than this guy made in a year. And he was making movies at the same time out of his own bank account. He always had this hope, this sort of whimsical hope that the movies would pay him back, you know, that he would make the money. Although, practically speaking, he would always say, I don't make big money, I make little money. He made little money.
Part of his power comes from the fact that essentially he was a great salesman.
Absolutely. People say he was like P.T. Barnum, you know, that he'd sit down next to you in a train, on a train, and he'd start telling you about himself. Hi, I'm Oscar Micheaux. Big smile. Then he'd start telling you about his next film and the film after that. And if you had any money, if you were a professional, he'd say, oh, maybe you want to buy my book. Maybe you want to invest in my movie. He picked up friends and he picked up collaborators and he picked up money wherever he went. And he was a super salesman. And it's important to say that he was a super salesman, not only of his novels and his films, but he was selling himself. He was selling his own life story, because in his novels and in his films, over and over again, he's telling his own life story. And that way, he really is the first, you know, film auteur. You know, it was intriguing to me to write the story of a film figure who never set foot in Hollywood. As far as we know, never set foot on a studio lot. Couldn't have gotten a job on a studio lot in the 30s because Hollywood was worse than Jim Crow, and they took absolutely no notice of anybody looking for a job who was black except in caricatured small roles.
It's important to say, too, that he never did any. There was never any real caricature. I mean, there was some sort of comedy stuff at a certain point because he was pushed that way by a critic a little bit. But the themes and the stories were, Warner's is always called the socially conscious studio, but, you know, basically they did stuff from the papers. What he did was took stuff from real life, from his own life, but also the things, the issues that black Americans at the time were talking about and very conscious of, and made them the subjects of his film.
Absolutely. Warner Brothers, you know, they wouldn't dare make a film that had a complete all-black cast or even had a subject about black people. When they made Fury about lynching, about a false lynching, it was meant to be an anti-lynching story, but the story had a star, Spencer Tracy. Now, the reason for that is because the films wouldn't be shown in the South. They would be banned by municipalities throughout the South, which was a major market, whereas Micheaux went after the small towns and the black neighborhoods of the South, and he only showed his movies in all-black theaters. The only theaters he could get to show his movies, and that was his audience. So he went after the audience that the major studios were for forsaking.
It's a very exciting show for me. I'm talking to Pat McGilligan. His new book is Oscar Micheaux, The Great and Only. It's an amazing biography of Oscar Micheaux. one of the things that so fascinates me about the book is the first third really gets into his life mirroring the black migration and the beginning of the black middle class in this country.
Absolutely. He has this wonderful life story. And I went down to this little town called Metropolis, which is on the Ohio River across from Kentucky, where his family were slaves. And they crossed over, around the time of the Emancipation Proclamation in order to live in southern Illinois. Illinois was supposedly hospitable to ex-slaves. Southern Illinois was still a Jim Crow area. If you go there to Metropolis today, sleepy river town with a completely segregated part of town, which is all black. Nobody knows where Michaud was born. I had to go and get out all these sort of dusty courthouse records and walk the fields and get the help of the local librarian to find out where he was born. And came from a family of real poverty, a lot of children. The mother believed in the example of Booker T. Washington, wanted her children to go to school and be educated. He never got beyond high school. It's because, and I think it was a great sorrow to him, and it was because he went to work. And he headed north to Chicago, which was the mecca for ex-slaves and for jobs, and eventually became a Pullman porter, which was considered a very wonderful occupation, if demeaning, for black men at the time. And you got to travel. He got tips. He sold himself on the trains as a Pullman porter. And then he eventually got fired for lifting money from a lady passenger's purse because there were all kinds of graft and knockdown practices going on among the Pullman porters because they didn't make enough money to live a decent life. And it was built into the system that they would be corrupt a little bit. So, yeah, he was following really a sort of fundamental trajectory of African-American history in his own life. And then from there, he decides, this isn't much of a life for me. I'm going to go west. I'm going to become a homesteader in South Dakota. And he goes out there for one of the last openings up of big Indian territory to landholders and ends up having a marvelous story as a homesteader, teaching himself how to, like, till the land and do the crops.
Yeah,
and
he goes from being a joke to one of the more successful farmers in the area.
Yeah, an innovative farmer. And meanwhile, he's got this romantic side. He hankers after women.
He's so lonely, though, because he's there by himself.
Very lonely. It's a very desolate place. There are terrible winters. He always goes to Chicago for his birthday, which is around the New Year of every year to celebrate. And he starts writing letters he'd met women as a Pullman porter. He was a womanizer, and he wanted to he had a word for it. He wanted to pick the perfect woman, the one true woman, you know, that would share his destiny as a successful homesteader. And he ended up picking out, after a series of misadventures, picking out a woman who was the daughter of an important minister, and who was an important minister who had a completely divergent view of life and politics than Michaud did. And then he has this tragic series of circumstances in his marriage, parts which he's partly to blame for, and his autobiographical fiction, I think he's relatively honest about that. But the marriage failed. Their baby dies. He's betrayed by the father, the minister. Publicly, he becomes a humiliated character in Chicago.
And this minister, we should also say, too. And this runs in through a lot of your biographies. There's like a central event that forms a lot of the people you've written about.
Absolutely.
And there's one in this case as well, isn't there?
Yes. He brings his bride out to the prairie, out to the frontier, and she becomes pregnant. And she's separated from her family. She's really a city girl. And the minister doesn't think much of this going west thing, and he comes to visit. But eventually what happens, she gets pregnant. She has a baby who dies in childbirth. And the father takes the wife back home. He goes to Chicago in a fury, and there's a public humiliation with a African-American reporter for the leading newspaper in the city, following him on the street as he's trying to get his wife to, like, open up the door and let him in. And he's on the front page, so he becomes publicly humiliated. Then the weather changes, and his fortunes fall with drought and with terrible winters, and he's no longer lucky as a farmer. And he turns all of this into his first novel, which is an autobiographical novel about the betrayal. The betrayal of his marriage, the betrayal of his wife, the betrayal of her father, and how he's publicly humiliated. And this becomes the overriding theme of most of his films, this basic story, this villainous minister, this hypocritical minister, which was a very controversial thing to write about in the black community at that time.
We should also just say, too, that minister even humiliated him when he was a young boy.
Oh, yeah. And it's very interesting part of his autobiographical fiction that this minister actually was someone who rode the rails and visited the outposts as part of his religious duties. And as a young boy, Michaud in Metropolis, they lived on a farm, and they used to serve Sunday dinner to the teachers and the elders. And this elder at that point in time came to visit him, and they served up a big feast, and Michaud was maybe 5 or 6 years old. And he was worried about not getting enough food, and he climbed onto the lap of his favorite teacher and started grabbing for the food. And he was interrupting the minister, who was flirting with the teacher at this point in time. The minister is a womanizer, too, in the story. And it causes a big family scene. He's spanked by his mother, and the father upbraids the mother, and he's banished to his room, and the minister lectures everybody. And he doesn't realize until he goes to Chicago, you know, almost 18, 19 years later, that this minister is the same one who caused this family incident. So it's this kind of ogre character. But the nice thing about Michaud is he's actually very reflective, and in his novels and in his films, but particularly in his novels, he sees that he himself at various times, you know, caused these things to happen.
It's The Treatment. My guest is Pat McGilligan. His new book is Oscar Michaud, The Great and Only. So much this again, and it relates to many of the people that you've written about, these childhood scars that push them in some ways. And also, like a number of the people you've written about, he's really kind of lonely and has to sort of build his own world. He turned to reading and writing basically because he was alone, either as a Pullman porter and the people would leave things behind for him to read, or when he's on the farm. And just is a way to turn away from that awful physical drudgery of just tilling the land all the time.
Absolutely. I think reading and writing were very important for him, both as a means of expression and as a way out of being a solitary human being, finding company, finding diversion. He created his own company by being a super salesman. I mean, he made friends wherever he went, so he had a tremendous circle of friends, and I mean across the country. But at the same time, he had this horrible scar of having this first marriage, which didn't work out. And then he was wary of women, and it took him another almost 10 years, you know, before he found another woman that he married, as far as we know. And also in the book, there's a shadow possible second wife. And yes, I think it's true. You know, when you think of any important person, you often think about what they're looking for. You know, it's in Citizen Kane with Rosebud. They're looking for love. They're looking for appreciation. They're looking for a means to express themselves. So at bottom, that's, you know, every human being's life story. And I think he was looking for those things. You know, he's looking for a way to express himself. He was looking for love. You know, he was looking to get satisfaction from those things. And that really drove him in his art.
I've got to say, though, so many of the things you've written, I think about Cukor or Lang or Hitchcock and Michaud as well, these are kind of intransigent outcasts. They refuse to be marginalized. And I wonder what attracts you to these kinds of people to write about.
Well, you know, the way I look at it, if I reflect on it, is I really find myself writing, you know, an alternative view of Hollywood history. I don't live in New York. I don't live in L.A. I live in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. I didn't grow up watching movies. Even today, I'd probably rather read a book or have a nice dinner. I honestly am not someone who has seen Rear Window 49 times, and actually I don't think it was made to be seen 49 times. So I'm trying to demythologize a lot about Hollywood. And the thing about Oscar Michaud that appealed to me was that, first of all, he is like the other people. He fits in as an artist. He's a great artist from my point of view. And he's outside of Hollywood. I mean, this is a guy who couldn't set foot in Hollywood. He couldn't have worked as a director. He couldn't have operated a clapboard. I mean, he couldn't have had the lowliest job. They wouldn't give the lowliest job because those jobs were unionized or they were paid. And it was worse than Jim Crow. I mean, you could get a better job in the South than you could get in Hollywood as a black person in the 1930s, unless you were willing to do, you know, various kinds of small character parts, most of which were demeaning. And so he created his own alternative universe. Now, it was happening. Other people were doing it as well. There was a lot of black filmmaking going on, and it was all with all black casts being shown to black audiences. But a lot of it was Fly By Night, Rise and Fall. This is a guy who, like, started, persisted all the way through to the end of his life with his last film, you know, which finally bankrupted him and killed him. So he persisted through the silent era, the 30s, the 40s, tremendous body of work, doing it against tremendous odds. And I think it's a very artistic vision.
My guest is author Patrick McGilligan. His new book is Oscar Michaud, The Great and Only. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment. More to come.
You're listening to The Treatment with Elvis Mitchell from the studios of KCRW Santa Monica.
Welcome back. It's The Treatment, which you can also hear at KCRW.com. When last we left author Patrick McGilligan, he was telling us more of the story of Oscar Michaud, which can be found in his great biography, Oscar Michaud, The Great and Only. He was constantly fighting about this sense of being marginalized, though. I mean, the black intelligentsia of Harlem basically sort of looked down on him because in their way, they were kind of like that minister you're talking about. They looked down on film.
Absolutely.
And because he wasn't an educated figure, because he wasn't part of the middle class,
absolutely.
He, from being sort of looked down upon by white farmers, he went to Harlem where he was looked down upon by the black middle class intelligentsia.
Absolutely. I think it's a tragic part of his story and probably of race pictures in general that they had to fight for appreciation and fight for recognition from the black press, from the black intelligentsia, from the black middle class. His own audience, the people that he was speaking to, were very fragmented and divided. And I think it reflected a lot of political and social divide going on in that community in general. Intellectuals looked down on film. They thought movies were lowbrow and people who wrote them were lowbrow. And you know what? Oscar Michaud was interested in the lowbrow. I mean, he was interested in common people. His films are about all levels of society. And you see, there are always black millionaires in them because that was one of his wishful ambitions.
Sure, there's a lot of idealized life in those films, too, in addition to a big vein of tragedy that he mined in so many of those films.
Absolutely. I think, honestly, his best films, he's realistic. His life was a bitter, bitter struggle. He didn't get rich. He was only famous in a small circle of black press people who appreciated films. But all of that whole industry, that whole business, black theaters and black neighborhoods were always substandard. They always fought for survival themselves. They nickel and dimed anybody who came and tried to show a movie there. It was a very, very hard scrabble business. So his circle of fame and his circle of appreciation is undoubtedly bigger today than it was then. Although everybody knew who he was, he got many, many reviews in which that said he was a genius of his time, at the time. So it wasn't as if he was totally unappreciated, but he also got scathing criticism, as you say, from black press and from intellectuals. So people were divided because he was making movies in low budget. He was making movies about controversial topics. He was making movies about his own life story. He was making all black movies, sometimes on a very, very low budget.
Well, let's talk about this one story that basically found its way into the majority of the films he made that are still extant. He fell in love with a young white woman when he was homesteading.
Yes.
And he fought getting involved with her because, first of all, the miscegenation laws were about to come into effect, but also he himself couldn't stand the idea of being involved with a white woman. So in so many of the films he made, well, talk about how that played itself out.
Well, it terrified him. His first great love, at least as we know it from his fiction and his films, was this Scottish blonde neighbor on the Rosebud, the land that was being homesteaded. And she was intelligent. He liked intelligent women. She wanted to read. They'd read together. He'd give her books, and he felt himself drawn to her. And then he felt himself really romantically drawn to her. But, he was a kind of a deep thinker on a lot of subjects, and the problems of intermarriage really bothered him. The problems of people who were African-American or had slave ancestry and were passing for white because there were greater social advantages really bothered him. He saw it and pointed it out even among people who went past through South Dakota in the towns that he lived. And he writes about it in his fiction. It bothered him. He felt these people were living a lie. He felt they were doomed to in some way punish themselves by the lie they were living. So he refused. He pulled himself back. He had some kind of affair with this Scottish blonde maiden, and then he pulled himself away from it. And I think he always regretted it. Then he went after, he made a list of his favorite girlfriend possibilities for his wife, and they were all going to be of his own skin color. And he went after them, one by one until he whittled it down to the woman he married, which turned out to be disastrous. So these series of circumstances then compelled him into, is all this family tragedy and what happened on the homestead to ruin his homesteading, and then into becoming a novelist. And then in a way, it compelled him into what I think is his great theme, and I think still a very profound theme, which is the idea in his books of people who are always trying to pass their skin color. They're either black trying to pass for white, or they're either you know, someone who falls in love with a white woman like himself, and they're terrified by this and don't know what to do. And then by the end of the story, because he found this fictional solution to this problem, by the end of the story, it turns out that this person doesn't even know that they themselves are African-American, which is a great delight to the audience. It was very crowd-pleasing, and it had confronted this issue. And, you know, he was against racial categorization. You know, he thought the minute that you started saying someone was black or white, then everybody was black, because if you go back, you'll find, you know, a drop of what was then called a drop of colored blood in anybody's genealogy. Well, we know he was prescient. We know it's true.
It's the treatment. My guess is Patrick McGilligan. His new book is Oscar Me Show, The Great and Only. I guess for me, though, as a filmmaker, for him, there's so much velocity in those works. I mean, he was working so quickly and making so many movies. As you mentioned in the book, he made as many movies as DeMille with far fewer resources. But what I liked about the films was that sense of him really using films as a kind of journalism. He did a version of Imitation of Life that was, in fact, much more tragic and sort of dealt with the fact that there wouldn't have been that moment of agonizing reappraisal at the end, that life would go on and you'd be trapped in that.
Yeah. Well, even autobiography is a form of journalism. I mean, he was reporting on himself at times. And there's one, you know, there's this interesting Leo Frank trial, which was a case in Atlanta when he was passing through Atlanta selling his second book, of this Jewish man, or the chief witness against him was a black man, and it riveted the whole nation. And eventually the Jewish man was convicted, and then eventually he was pulled out of the prison and lynched. So you have this complete, you know, bizarre, contradictory case for the South of a black man being the chief witness against a white man who is then lynched. So it's the opposite of everything you think. And Michaud used this as the basis of two films, two totally remarkable films, a silent version, which is lost, and a sound version, which still exists, called Lem Hawkins's Confession, in which he casts everybody as black, but he gives them the same kind of roles, and he takes dialogue directly from the court transcripts from that case.
And of course, to sort of deal with the way you sort of talked in your other books about the legacy of film that all these other filmmakers have. I mean, for good or ill, we can pretty much go out and find complete versions of the films by those filmmakers. But because he only could make so many prints, and because these films would either be edited at the theaters or were run so often that they would essentially fall apart, much of his great work doesn't exist today.
And whittled away by censors, because wherever he went, especially in the South, here's a film starring all black people about a black theme, you know, about black life. Well, Southern censors went crazy and they would take pieces out of it. And the expense in those days, the big expense after production was the number of prints that you'd strike. Well, after production, he had no money left, so he would always strike, you know, two or three or four prints, as opposed to, you know, 50 that MGM was printing or 500 that MGM was printing.
And of course, MGM still owned its negatives, so at some point they could strike more copies if they needed to.
Yeah, but rarely did, because they rarely went back. He kept moving. He would keep going and make the next film. But he would take these films, send them off either with friends or salesmen or sometimes himself under arms, and he would take them to theater by theater. And eventually then, you know, when he covered the main theaters and got some money back, he'd start sending them by mail. So they became lost. They'd end up at the last theater that they were shown, as you say, nicked, damaged. So out of the, you know, nearly 50, we don't know exactly how many films he made. That's part of the fun of his story, because some he claimed to have made, some he abandoned to creditors, some were bought, you know, at auction after court cases involving him. You know, only a handful survive, and probably only two or three survive in a way that we can see what he meant for them to look like. You know, they're not restored in the way that, you know, important Hollywood studio films are restored and released to America on DVD. There was no one around to do that. He didn't have a company. He didn't have money to do that. He died in 1951, a pauper. And his widow, as far as we know, burned his surviving prints. So the prints always existed in the end in the hands of the last theater owner, or sometimes some collector who got their hands on it. And every once in a while, a place like, you know, the Eastman Kodak House, you know, that happened to have a very good print of Body and Soul, which is one of the best ones that you can see to see an example of his genius. On the one hand, you have this guy that Haskell Wexler, the great cameraman, told me. He worked with him at the beginning of his career in Chicago.
Yeah, well, Haskell was a teenager and he was making a film.
Haskell was a teenager.
He's
one of his last films. He always remembered Oscar Michaud saying, okay, next scene, change the pictures on the wall. walls. They didn't have money for new scenery, so they just switched the pictures around and moved the furniture around. And Haskell said, actually, it's not such bad advice for, you know. So you see those kind of scenes, but then you also see storm scenes and scenes of violence and scenes of lynchings, which actually really riveted and terrified and divided audiences that saw them. And great Harlem musical acts, you know, of the 1930s, filmed very, very well, with very respectfully. You see these kind of scenes that he did very, very well when he had the money, when he had the means, when he had the time.
It's The Treatment. Again, my guest is Patrick McGilligan. His book is Oscar Michaud, the Great and Only. You mentioned, use the phrase hard-hitting, and one of the things I really like about his movies, I mean, he loved boxing, and not only as a sport, but also what it represented for the race. And that was a key part to a number of the things he did in the film.
Yes. One of his great early silent successes was a film that really took off on the subject of Jack Johnson, and used actually boxers in the film that had fought with him. And it was obviously, you know, a parable of his life to a certain extent. And, you know, he was a big man who loomed over people, Oscar Michaud was. And people say that in the homesteading days that he liked to box. He would box, take comers on, you know, and that it was something he did as an amateur. I don't know whether that story is true, but he followed sports. And he, you know, sports to him were like the arts, you know. It was segregated. There would be black champions in every category if they were allowed to compete equally. So, and then when Joe Louis came along, he made, you know, another story towards the end of his career, the notorious Eleanor Lee, which is all about, you know, a great black boxer who's fighting a German Superman who's a white guy. It's one of his rare movies that has quite a few white characters. And usually the white characters are played by black actors. But in this case, towards the end of his career, he was casting some white actors. And it's a obvious, you know, it's Joe Louis and it's Max Schmeling. And it's an obvious parable about what happened there. And he uses you know, the dignity and the pride and the toughness of the boxer as a metaphor for what he believed in for the uplift. Uplifting of the race, which is what he always called it, the uplifting of the race.
But also that competitive streak in him that existed, too. The boxing gave him a real vent for that, didn't it?
Yeah, and I think, you know, he was competitive even in his own field. I talk about, you know, that race pictures was cutthroat. And, you know,
and
look,
he didn't like that there were white men who also were controlling
it,
too.
No, it's a very, very interesting part of his story. I had to really think about it and try and treat it as decently as possible. He was very early on thinking about the influence of Jews and show business. They owned the theater, most of the theaters that he was peddling to. Sometimes they invested in his movies. He resented them, and yet he was beholden to them, and yet he liked some of them, and yet he hated some of them, and some of them had him arrested, and then others of them bailed him out. And so they crop up in his movies, and the idea of Leo Frank being Jewish haunted him, and he followed that idea all the way through to the end of his life in films and books. And so he was very interested in this modern idea of, like, Jews and blacks, can they get along when Jews actually have all the money that the blacks don't have for certain purposes? And in show business, even in black show business, it was true then.
Well, this has certainly been the fastest 28 minutes I've ever had in the history of the show. My guest is Patrick McGilligan. His book is Oscar Michaud, The Great and Only. Pat, thanks so much for doing this.
Thank you, Alice. I'm very glad to be here.
Our technical director at KCRW and the editor in Santa Monica is Bob Carlson, with technical assistance at Carnegie Recording Studios from Noriko Okabe and Stephen Harwood. Gemma Dempsey's the producer. I'm going to go get a workout. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.
An audio archive of this and other programs can be found at kcrw.com. For questions and comments about The Treatment, please email us at thetreatment@kcrw.com. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.